From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Dinesh D'Souza is one of the country's most prominent and controversial conservatives. He's out with a new book, America, Imagine a World Without Her, that's spent time at number one on Amazon and number two on the New York Times bestseller list, and out with a companion film, America, Imagine the World Without Her, that's done $13 million in box office since its release this month. D'Souza has made his name with go-for-the-jugular attacks on liberal America so all-out that even some conservatives have bridled. He says no apologies, even on his way to jail. This hour on Point, Dinesh D'Souza and his no-apologies vision of America. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Do you follow D'Souza? What do you think? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. In just a few minutes, we'll be joined by a tough D'Souza critic, David Korn of Mother Jones magazine. Joining me now from San Diego, California, is Dinesh D'Souza, out with his book, America, his movie, America. His 2012 documentary, 2016 Obama's America, took in $33 million, the second highest grossing political documentary ever, right behind Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. Dinesh D'Souza is facing jail time this fall for violating campaign finance laws. Dinesh D'Souza, welcome to On Point.
Hey, Tom. It's good to be on the show.
Happy to have you here. It is very unusual for us to have somebody who's looking at jail time. Can you clarify exactly what people will think? What is up with that? You have pled to the felony of campaign finance violation, and this fall you face is it up to 2 years?
Yeah, that's the maximum penalty. I exceeded the campaign finance law by $20,000. What happened is that a college friend of mine, Wendy Long, was running for the Senate in New York. I convinced two of my friends to give her $10,000, and I reimbursed them. It was stupid. It was wrong. I shouldn't have done it. Now, that being said, I do want to point out that here is Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, who has been transferring money from his campaign to pay for his granddaughter's wedding, and there are innumerable other cases like that. My issue here is I should be held accountable for what I did, but I don't like the fact that under the Obama administration, it appears like Lady Justice has taken off her blindfold and is winking at her friends and going after her adversaries.
You say and have said that they're coming after you. Your attorney said the same thing. Of course, the prosecutor here, Parit Bharara, another Indian-American, hasn't had any of that. He says, look, there's a violation here, and we've prosecuted. You told the judge, I knew that causing a campaign contribution to be made in the name of another was wrong and something the law forbids. I deeply regret my conduct. What's your attorney telling you about likely time?
Well, it's hard to say. I think that the prosecution will probably ask for jail time. Obviously, my attorneys will ask for community service and a fine, and a judge will decide what he thinks is appropriate. Let me just put it this way. Think of it, if Michael Moore, the filmmaker, had done what I did. And again, remember that this is not a case involving corruption. I didn't seek to benefit myself in any way. As I put it, this was a misguided attempt to help a friend. And if the Bush administration had
also
sought
a felony.
Give,
we have to, also a felony.
No, my point is if Michael Moore had done the same thing under the same circumstances and the Bush administration sought to lock him up for 2 years, I think you would be outraged. Many of your listeners would be outraged. So we've got to keep in mind that we don't want to have a government
that uses...
I don't know about that.
You're presuming about my sentiments or my listeners' sentiments there, and I'm not sure you're correct. I just wanted to get it out there where that stands. And we understand that you feel singled out, that you feel that this administration came after you. Of course, you've been very critical of the Obama administration.
Well, let me just point this out. I mean, I don't know if I'm singled out, but as I look around the country, I see something new happening in American politics, something that Jimmy Carter would not have done, Bill Clinton would not have done. My partner, Jerry Molin, a longtime partner of Steven Spielberg, he's made movies like Jurassic Park and Schindler's List. Yep. Right after the two of us issued the film 2016, the IRS comes down on him. The IRS has been going after the conservatives in Hollywood. It's been going after Tea Party groups. So this idea that you use the FEC, the SEC, the IRS to relentlessly go after your critics, that's kind of un-American, isn't it?
Felonies, too, not exactly something we celebrate. Look, I want to ask you, first of all, about your effect on an audience. I have a stack here. I don't know. It's the thickest stack I've ever had coming into a show of people protesting the fact that we're even talking to you.
I mean, right. This is the hottest, most tolerant on NPR.
Well, no, you're
here. They object
to
even having a point of view on the show.
Excuse me. You are here. You are on the air nationally right now. That is NPR tolerance in action. But I'm just saying, there's an unbelievable reaction against you, your ideas, your presence here on the part of some. What is it about your message, do you think, that is so provocative to so many who might be listening right now?
Here's what it is, Tom. Look, let me tell you a little bit of where I'm coming from, okay? I grew up in a middle-class family in India. Now, middle-class in India means you grew up without a phone, without TV, without hot water. We had a car, but if you looked at the floor of our car, you could see the road. So I grew up, in a sense, in a very different world. I come to America, and I'm stunned by the abundance that America offers to the ordinary man. I'm stunned by the sense of possibility in this country, the idea that you can write the script of your own life. And then I set foot on the Dartmouth campus, and I essentially encounter a culture of spoiled brats, starting off with Obama and on down. And all these guys are raised in the luxury of America. Obama's a walking example of America's exceptionalism. If he had been born in Kenya, he'd probably be living in the hut right next to George Obama in the Huruma slum of Nairobi. So America has made his life possible, and yet he not only denies but derides American exceptionalism. He goes around the world apologizing for America.
I've heard him praise America many times.
So here's what I want to say. What I'm saying is I, as an immigrant, having lived in another culture and recognizing the uniqueness of America, I'm encountering in America a leftist narrative about America, a story of American shame that is selective, it's manipulated, it's distorted, it's wrong. And so my film and my work is intended to combat that. So I'm not surprised when people feel uncomfortable. I'm not surprised when leftists start screaming. It's because their ideology is at stake. They've spent a lot of time manufacturing this narrative, and I'm challenging it.
Here's what I understand what you're up to there. I've spent a lot of time in India, lived there for a year, and been many times. Here's what I don't quite get, Dinesh. I don't see a problem with being critical of this country and at the same time understanding its greatness. And you do seem to have a problem with that.
Absolutely.
Why is
not
that? What shouldn't a great country, when you look at slavery or you look at the Native Americans, or these are the issues you're talking about in your book, America, and in the film, when you look at some of our wars abroad, why shouldn't a great country like this one be capable of being both self-critical and aware of its greatness at the same time? You seem to have a problem with that.
I absolutely don't. There are two rival spirits in America. One can be called the spirit of 1776, and the other can be called the spirit of 1968. Now, these are generalizations, but they do reflect two different sensibilities. The real difference between the left and the right is not that one is critical of America and the other isn't. I'm just as critical of America as you or David Korn, except I criticize the spirit of 1968. In my opinion, the spirit of 1776 is entrepreneurial, self-reliant, uncomplaining, adventurous. It represents, if you will, the spirit that built this country. The spirit of 1968 is a spirit that is hypercritical. It's anti-American. It fails to appreciate what's good about this country. It ultimately is a spirit of sitting in the bandwagon rather than pulling the bandwagon. And it's a spirit that looks at America as on balance, as having been a force for negative in the world instead of positive.
That's a pretty
really
broad brush on 1968. To be in the spirit of 1776, do you have to go to work to defend slavery, to defend what happened with Native Americans in this country? Is that, you know, part and parcel?
Tom, I can kind of assure you that you haven't seen my film, because anyone who thinks I'm defending slavery, I begin the film with about 20 minutes in which I bring in all the leading critics of America. And I don't just mean the liberals. I bring in the far left, the MIT radical Noam Chomsky, even the former domestic terrorist Bill Ayers. We have Michael Moore. We have Obama. We have Elizabeth Warren. And I allow them to make their case, if you will, against American foreign policy, against American capitalism, against American history. Now, by the way, this is far more than Michael Moore does. His strategy is ambush. He shows up at Charlton Heston's house. He tries to make his critics look stupid. He'll never have intelligent conservatives in his films. I let the left speak to such a point that there are conservatives who have walked out of my movie because they feel that I've basically gone over to the Michael Moore camp. But then I turn around and answer them. So no, I depict slavery in all its lurid horror, but I also point out, A, that slavery was going on all over the world. B, there were 3,500 black slave owners in America who owned more than 10,000 black slaves. Ask yourself why you didn't know about that before. And C, America is the only country to fight a great war to end slavery. Those are facts, too.
Yes, I'm not sure that everybody would pull out the same parade of facts to examine slavery. As you say, not everybody does. And yes, you've got people in here who don't share your view. I just have the feeling at the end of the day, I think this is a greater country than you do, because I think it can deal with deep, serious criticism when that's merited. And that's part of its greatness.
Tom, we agree on this. The point here's where we're disagreeing. I'm saying that our greatness is not a departure from the spirit of 1776, but a return to it. So when Martin Luther King says, I'm submitting a promissory note and I'm demanding that it be cashed, what's he talking about? Who wrote him a note?
Also pushing it forward. And if he'd have lived, he would have kept pushing it forward right beyond 1968. Why not? Do you always have to go back?
The point is that the promissory note was the Declaration of Independence. So here's it's a supreme irony. A Virginia planter who owned 200 slaves is also the author of the very document that made possible the civil rights movement.
A lot of ironies in our history. You point out many of them. Others might point out more. Dinesh D'Souza is with us this hour. His new book is America, Imagine a World Without Her. His film, America, Imagine the World Without Her. David Korn joins us in just a moment. Dinesh D'Souza facing jail time this fall. Please stand by there in San Diego. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour with controversial conservative Dinesh D'Souza, facing jail time for campaign finance violations and still out there with his no apologies vision of America, the 1776 view, as he puts it. Out with a new book, America, Imagine a World Without Her, with a companion film, America, Imagine the World Without Her. The book was number one on Amazon for a time, number two on the New York Times bestseller list. There is a big audience for this man. The film has grossed $13 million. His previous film, which really went after Barack Obama in the run-up to the 2012 election, took in $33 million, second highest grossing political documentary ever after Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11. Here's Dinesh D'Souza from his new film, America, Imagine the World Without Her.
If America did not exist, the conquest ethic would dominate the world once again. America isn't the problem. America is the answer.
America's not the problem, it's the answer. He says it again and again. He says Barack Obama doesn't share that view. I don't know. Here was the president, July 4th, at a gathering of military families. This was last year at the White House, saying America is the greatest nation on earth, and then explained why.
What makes us great is not our size or our wealth, but our values and our ideals and the fact that we're willing to fight for them. A land of liberty and opportunity, a global defender of peace and freedom, a beacon of hope for people everywhere who cherish those ideals.
Not good enough for Dinesh D'Souza. With us right now as well from Washington, D.C., Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine, author of Showdown, the Inside Story of How Obama Fought Back Against Boehner, Cantor, and the Tea Party, former Washington editor of The Nation, David Korn. David Korn, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. I wish I could say I was happy to be here.
You're not happy. Why?
Because I think Dinesh is really fomenting tripe. That, you know, everything he's told you, everything that's in his film, is factually unsupportable. He says Obama doesn't believe America is exceptional. Yet in a speech he gave just last fall, he says to the UN, I believe America is exceptional, in part because we've shown a willingness to sacrifice of blood and treasure to stand up for not only our own interests, but for the interests of all. He says that a sign of American greatness is that we fought a war to end slavery. Now, that is about as backwards as it comes. If America had been truly great at that particular moment, then it would have not been necessary to fight a war.
Well, okay, but come on, we did stand up and fight it. My own folks stood up and fought it. I don't want to belittle that, what they fought for.
England got rid of slavery without fighting a war.
Yeah.
We had half of America fighting that war because it believed in slavery and was willing to die to protect slavery. That's not a sign of greatness. That's a sign that America had a gigantic problem that could only be resolved with the most dramatic means rather than through peaceable debate and resolve short of violence. Now, I'm not saying America is not a great country, but that is not a sign of greatness. That is the opposite. Yet the fact that he makes millions of dollars peddling this swill is really kind of disturbing and discouraging.
Do you ever worry, David, that the country could get too negative on its own story? Does that fear ever concern you on its own narrative?
No, I don't even know what that means, get too negative on its own story. Americans, if anything, often think better of themselves in general, as most people do, than they should. And looking at things that have happened in the past, whether it's Vietnam, slavery, massacre of Native Americans, are things that don't get a lot of attention in a day-to-day context. We tend to think we are number one, and we are in many ways, but not in every way.
Dinesh, a little self-criticism isn't a bad thing, even a lot, David Corn would say, and maybe deserved. What's the real philosophical parting of ways here, Dinesh?
Yeah, I think, you know, we can start by burrowing into the facts a little bit. Here's the fact. 300,000 northern soldiers died to secure for the slaves a freedom that the slaves were not in a position to secure for themselves. Emerson described it beautifully when he said this was not a revolution of the oppressed, it was a repentance of the tyrant. So that's a great American achievement, which is the ending of slavery. Now, David says, wait a minute, they did it first in Britain, they did it first in France. True.
And that's true, and they did it without civil war.
But let me finish. But there were very few slaves in Britain and France. Remember,
well,
slavery.
Does that make
hold
us
on, hold on. Us.
Guys, don't shout. Let me finish.
Yeah?
Slavery was embedded into the fabric of American life.
Yeah.
Now, the founders didn't create that. The British created that. America came into the world in which slavery was universal. And so the point I'm trying to make is it was much more difficult to eradicate slavery in this country. A great war had to be fought. Now, David says half the country fought for slavery. Not true. Most of the Southern soldiers who fought on the Southern side did not have slaves. They were fighting to protect a Southern way of life because there were Northern soldiers down
but
there.
But slaves
so
were
that's
central to that way
also.
Of life. Come on.
No, you know, I'm saying when poor whites who don't have slaves are fighting, they're not fighting for slavery.
Well, that's quite debatable. Your point is that it's debatable. Because their economy was dependent on slaves.
Hey, Tom.
Yes.
Their economy was hurt by slaves because slaves were working for free.
And speaking of the spirit of 1776,
yes,
that Dinesh loves to cite, in 1776 there was a debate over whether there should be slavery or not in the United States. And a lot of people, you know, from the North mainly, but Jefferson actually believed this, John Adams, wanted at that point in time to rid the country of slavery. But yet Southern states, and, you know, whether they were poor or not poor, people down there were in favor of keeping it. It took almost 100 years until there was a bloody fight to get rid of slavery. And the people fought in the North for that deserve a lot of credit. The people who fought in the South to preserve that way of life, for whatever their motives, deserve a lot of shame and blame. And then after that war was over, it took another 100 years to get somewhat close to equal rights for the people who were the descendants of the slaves. Now, if that's a story of greatness, then we are really in a black and white world here, in which black is white. That's not a story of greatness. That's a story of a country and a people taking far too long to deal with something that was considered immoral by a great many Americans as early as 1776, if not before.
I want to ask
Hold
you
on.
Each.
Let,
a,
let
I want to ask
that.
You each. I don't want to spend the whole hour on slavery. I think we've got the boundaries laid down. But I want to ask you each a question, and I'll put it to both of you. But first to you, Dinesh, and I'll put it to you, David. Dinesh's books have been big sellers. His movie, $33 million, that's big for a political or polemical documentary, whatever you want to call it. He's in the kind of Michael Moore stream. That's big. Only Michael Moore has done bigger. Dinesh, who's your audience? Why does it have this size? What is it?
All right. Here's the point. My audience is an audience of patriotic Americans who have a natural love of America in their breast. If they read Mother Jones or The Nation, what they do is they get ultimately, I could call it the shaming of America. And there is grounds for shame. Nowhere in my movie do I deny the facts of the conquest of land from the Indians or slavery. But I do point out things like, look, you have to judge people by the choices available to them at the time. When the 13 states gathered in Philadelphia to debate the Constitution, slavery was legal in every single state. If the founders had outlawed slavery at the outset, it's arguable that no state, but certainly not the southern states, would have joined the Union. Then America might have been several countries, and slavery might have lasted much longer. So in statesmanship, we judge people by the actual choices available to them. Jefferson wanted to get rid of slavery, but he knew he couldn't. That's the point. He recognized that it would be better to have a constitution that embraced anti-slavery principles, yeah, even while allowing slavery to continue, yeah, for a, yeah, time.
We know the history. You're circling back. David Korn, you see this audience. You see the sales figures for the movie,
first,
for
I
the
have
book.
To say,
yes.
I defy Dinesh to go to any issue of Mother Jones the last year or two, take it, and find that the predominant theme is the shaming of America. That is just flat out wrong, and I'll make a bet if he wants to try to win the bet. But, you know, the magazine will shame people. We'll shame corporate polluters.
Yep.
We'll shame people who deny climate change. But the shaming of America, that is not a theme at all present in our copy. So
corruption should be a pride, a matter of pride.
Yeah,
okay,
so,
point,
you know,
taken. What about the audience, David?
Well, listen, it's not surprising to me that his conspiracy theories that claim that Barack Obama wants to destroy America, which is literally what he has said, that he's a secret plan because his father was a raging anti-colonialist in Kenya, that because of that, Barack Obama wants to destroy America. Doesn't surprise me that that swill finds an audience when you have already two-thirds of Republicans who say that Obama should be impeached, and they who do believe, many of them, that he's a secret Muslim, that he wasn't born in America. I'm not attributing all this to Dinesh, but I'm saying there's an audience out there of profound Obama haters, and they, you know, relish, you know, a product, whether it's a movie or a book, that feeds their paranoia, feeds their worst instincts, and I congratulate Dinesh for making millions of dollars off this hatred.
Dinesh, it's not just Barack Obama that you go after on that front. You go after liberals, progressives in general, and you say they are planning national suicide. I'm reading right here from your book. It seems pretty over the top, but what do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is not the suicide in the sense of trying to destroy America, the landmass, or America, the country, but the American era. I would call it the era of American superiority. See, we've been living in a time since World War II in which America has been the dominant force in the world. America's standard of living has been virtually incomparable in the world. Nothing can happen of importance in South America or the Middle East or Asia without America having a big say-so or even controlling the outcome. So what the progressives want to do is make America a normal country. And a normal country is like Canada. So when things happen in the world, the Canadians have a point of view, but no one really cares. Why? Because Canada is a normal country. America has been an abnormal country, and I think the progressives consider that unjust. Why should a country with 5% of the world's population enjoy so much of the world's wealth, have so much influence around the world? And so, no, Obama's not trying to destroy America in that sense. What he's trying to do is shrink America.
Maybe we need a little normalcy. I mean, we went into Iraq for all those years. We spent all that money. That was not typical national behavior in this day and age. It was ours. What did it gain us, Dinesh?
I think in retrospect, it was a mistake. We should not have gone into Iraq. Our reasons for going into Iraq turned out to be wrong.
But it sounds like that's the kind of thing you are supporting.
Obama was right about that. Wait a second. This is a good point. So Obama and the progressives were right about that, about not going in. And one of the major reasons was that if we went in there, it would actually harm and undermine American credibility throughout the region and throughout the world. And indeed, it did. So in that instance, Americans wanted to protect this valuable resource that America has. Progressives wanted to protect this.
Yes.
And yet Bush and Cheney and the others squandered it on this adventure that even Dinesh D'Souza says was wrong-headed.
Dinesh,
so again,
a fair criticism,
black is white.
And does it come back to a kind of criticism of your perspective, Dinesh?
Well, first of all, in Iraq, as in Vietnam, America has made huge mistakes. The point I think is worth making, however, is that these are not mistakes that were made out of the desire to steal from those countries or have imperial control over them. Look, we've wasted all this money in Iraq. That's not normal imperialist behavior. Normal imperialist behavior would be to go to Iraq and then say, look, every penny that we have spent in this country, we're going to take back by taking Iraqi oil. We haven't done that. We've turned the oil fields back to the Iraqis, and we've said, it's your oil, you can use it, you can sell it, you can burn it. So ultimately, what America did in Iraq was mistaken, but it wasn't evil.
Dinesh, David, it's Tampa. I want to get our listeners in here, if I may. Lots are lined up here. Austin, Texas, John is calling. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
And Dinesh and David.
Hello.
Say, you know, before we talk about great, how about we talk about good? You know, a good country, a good person realizes there are consequences for what they do, even unintended consequences.
True.
They didn't mean to do bad, but you know, it turned out wrong. If you step on someone's toe, you say I'm sorry. You know, excuse me. If you broke their toe, you say, gosh, I really hurt you. I apologize. What can I do?
So take it national. Take it to this conversation, John. What are you suggesting?
What I'm suggesting is that there's no shame in admitting that we have made mistakes, that these mistakes have been lasting, enduring, and in some cases have been life-changing for peoples both in and out of this country, to acknowledge that and then to take steps to try to remedy it and make sure we never do it again. That becomes not just good, that becomes great. That's what makes us great.
John, stick with us. Dinesh, would you put then our caller from Austin, Texas, in the once national suicide category that you've...
No, on the contrary, I agree with his principle completely. I mean, let's begin by saying that there is a difference between slipping on a banana skin and landing on someone's foot and kicking them. So he acknowledges that. That's an important acknowledgement, because once we get the truth of the facts out there, we can then ask, what do we do about it? Now, here's the point. America pulled out of Vietnam. We did nothing for Vietnam. But look at the way that other countries from China to India and Singapore all around the world have been taking the American formula of technological capitalism and lifting hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. Now, the progressives have been active in countries like India for 40 years. And India was the begging bowl of the world. Why? Because you gave us aid, and then you gave us loans, and then when we couldn't pay it back, you gave us more loans to pay back the old loans. This is progressive, quote, helping. What India needs is not progressive helping. What India needs is global markets so that the Indians can make stuff that other people want to buy.
I mean, I saw Bill Clinton push quite a lot for global markets.
I saw him and Hillary push for microloans, and I see progressives in America critiquing the World Bank style of international aid that Dinesh just described. So once again, his use of terminology is slippery, and he's always pivoting. It's progressives in America who have criticized that form of aid that you just described. Not
so, David. Let me ask you this: Do you celebrate the spread of technological capitalism around the world?
That's
yes
a big question
the,
and another
what the heck
question.
Does
in general,
that mean?
In general, are you happy
I love
about
technology,
it?
And I see nothing wrong with capitalism when it works in the right way. I don't think capitalism worked so well in September 2008, and the markets crashed because of financial speculation, and millions of Americans outside of Wall Street lost jobs that they would never get back again, while the guys who engineered this and the gals still kept their homes in East Hampton.
Well, I happen
and
to see, agree with
nothing,
you on that.
And there's nothing – and well, if you agree with me or not, that's the liberal
we
critique
shouldn't
of what happened.
The banks. We shouldn't have bailed out any of those companies.
Well, excuse me, support those bailouts? Excuse me. It was mainly liberals, not conservatives, who raised those issues. Although I do say, in this instance, there were some conservatives who came along too. But it's mainly liberals who have talked about the excesses of big finance. And it's Barack Obama, who you call this wide-eyed socialist in league with Hillary Clinton, who has actually disappointed what you might call Elizabeth Warren Democrats by not being hard enough on the banks, which is hardly very Saul Alinsky of him. So once you start talking about any real issue here, Dinesh, you get tied up in your own metaphors and theology.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with controversial conservative Dinesh D'Souza, facing jail time this fall for campaign finance violations, and still out there with his No Apologies Vision of America. In a new book, America, Imagine a World Without Here, in a companion film, America, the book has been way up on the bestseller list, number one on Amazon for a time, number two on the New York Times. The film not doing badly, maybe not as badly as well as the last going after Obama in the 2012 campaign. Dinesh D'Souza joins us today from San Diego, California. And with us from Washington, David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine, author of Showdown. Mike in Burlington, Vermont. Mike, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My comment today is that On Point is one of my favorite shows that I listen to on NPR, and what I really appreciate about it is the level of debate that usually is on the show. I feel that today you've kind of fallen to the level of, say, Fox News or MSNBC, like something sort of like just an opinion channel. And Mr. D'Souza is just sort of like your garden variety fear-monger conspiracy theorist.
You think we're just foxing around? Let me ask you, Mike. Here's the reason we debated whether to do it, and here's the reason we did. Dinesh D'Souza, whatever you think of his views, has got a lot of readers and plenty of people who show up to his movies. And this debate, you know, some version of it seems to be riding under an awful lot of political tension in this country. We thought, well, let's just put it out there and see if we can lance a little bit of the boil. Is that worthwhile, Mike?
No, I don't think so, because I think the kind of person that Dinesh appeals to is the least common denominator. It's, I mean, you know, the most popular TV shows on TV are reality shows, and they're probably some of the, you know, the lowest quality TV that you can actually see.
Well, fair enough, but this is national public radio. I mean, once in a while, you know, if that's part of the public, do we not have some obligation to reach out and, you know, bring in that whole hopper?
I think that you could have different viewpoints, but yeah, when you go to the level of just someone who is spewing propaganda from a very biased view, I don't feel that that's something that has much value.
You've kind of got my take on it and our reasons for it, but I really appreciate your call, Mike. David Korn, you know, I mean, you heard my explanation right there. Is it a mistake to even entertain Mr. D'Souza in a forum like this?
I am somewhat sympathetic with the caller, and I almost decided not to go on the show for that reason. I mean, most people who know my work know that there are very few times I say no to TV and radio.
You're out there.
But I do think, you know, and I debate conservatives all the time.
Yeah.
But I do think that Dinesh and his attacks on the president, not because he's attacking the president, but that they go beyond the borders of what should be, you know, substantial debate. To say that Barack Obama is trying to destroy America, hates America, secret socialist because his father was an anti-colonialist Kenyan, things like that are just completely idiotic.
David, you
wrote that story
idiotic
for Forbes. No, no.
Well, Dinesh,
that's exactly what you've said.
Yes,
you explained Barack Obama's hatred for America by pointing to the father
David
he met only once. And then you did a book, you did a documentary.
Let's keep it cool. Remember Mike in Burlington, Vermont. Let's keep it cool and just as thoughtful as we can make it. Dinesh, I've read you, and you certainly do say that you found an anti-colonial root in President Obama's view of the world and the country.
Absolutely. Obama's father was, in fact, a raging anti-colonialist. And Obama, I remind you, hold on, let me finish.
What?
Did write a book called Dreams from My Father. By the way, not Dreams of My Father, but Dreams from My Father. Meaning, here are the dreams that I, Obama, got.
And there were many dreams
dad
in there. But what's wrong with what David just said? He said you're out
David
of bounds.
David said I'd accused Obama of being a socialist. Earlier, he used the word Muslim. One of the reasons I've been arguing with other conservatives is I've been disputing the idea that Obama is a socialist, that he's a Muslim, that he's a Manchurian candidate. So David knows, if he's read my work, that I do not say those things, but he's lumping me together.
You say he and Hillary Clinton have a secret plan that comes from Saul Alinsky to weaken, destroy America,
David,
and they want to do it consciously.
That's almost verbatim.
Don't play footsie here, Dinesh.
I'm not playing footsie. Okay, let me talk about Alinsky. Alinsky was
Why?
A guy who learned. Hold on.
Why?
Alinsky? I'll tell you why. Because not only did Obama keep going back to Chicago to study Alinsky.
This is the Chicago community
Clinton
organizer.
Wrote a thesis. Hold on. Why can't I speak?
No,
Hillary
because,
Clinton.
Excuse
met
me, Dinesh.
Alinsky
I just want
school.
To define for people who Saul Alinsky is. Not everybody is as obsessed with Saul Alinsky, you know, as you may be. And just to say that he was a very influential sort of thought leader around social organizers, community organizers out of Chicago. Please go on.
Yeah. Saul Alinsky also paid a tribute in his book Rules for Radicals to Lucifer, the devil. So I'm not the one who's being provocative here. He is.
Sort of Rolling
Alinsky
Stone,
is.
But I listen to them.
Well, listen,
second
Hillary
of all, hold on.
Hillary
let me finish.
Clinton was offered a job by Saul Alinsky after doing a dissertation on him. She turned him down. She also volunteered for Barry Goldwater when she was in high school. So maybe she's a secret Goldwater sleeper agent. And you look at what Barack
David,
Obama did. He's done protecting Wall Street more
got
than
it,
going
David,
after
but let's
him,
go to Dinesh.
According to
but,
some.
But
I mean, this is ridiculous, Tom. That's one reason why I don't want to come on and debate whether Barack Obama is a sleeper agent of Saul Alinsky, because it's just completely made up and people want to believe it because they have their own prejudices, not because of a single fact.
Dinesh?
The reason David's getting so agitated is in this film, we have rare footage of Alinsky that's really never been seen in America. And in this footage, Alinsky, by the way, who happens to be a mentor, not just to Obama, but to Hillary, talks about how he learned
not
a lot
mentor.
Of his shakedown tactics from the mafia. He talks about hanging out with the Al Capone gang, and he talks about admiring the fact that those people had learned how to extract money from people. And Alinsky speculates, how can I do that politically? And
what
this guy happens to be
Barack
somebody
Obama
who's at, well,
yeah,
Barack
Dinesh, when you start talking about
bill.
The devil and the mob as though that's at the heart of our American problem right now.
What does
now?
That have to do with saving Detroit,
listen,
with the stimulus bill? What does that have to do with getting Obama in the
listen
what does
to
that
the,
do with
hey,
the unemployment being 6.1%?
Yep.
It has nothing to do with anything. It's just noise that some people want to buy.
Because I can see why you want to shut it down.
Let me take it, if I may. You're using a pretty big brush here on the president, on Hillary Clinton. You just raised her again. Here was Hillary Clinton. This was earlier this month on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, the former Secretary of State and Senator and First Lady and quite possibly candidate for president. Maybe she'll be our first female president, our next president. Here she was. This hardly sounds like apologizing for America to me.
We have not been telling our story very well. We do have a great story. We are not perfect by any means, but we have a great story about human freedom, human rights, human opportunity. And let's get back to telling it to ourselves first and foremost, and believing it about ourselves, and then taking that around the world. That's what we should be standing for.
Dinesh D'Souza, there's Hillary Clinton, and it hardly sounds like an American apologist.
Yeah, I endorse that statement 100%. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal just a week or so ago about how Hillary is now moving away from Obama. In other words, she doesn't like the anti-Americanism that Obama has been representing in the world. She was Obama's Secretary of State. She's now trying to carve out a more positive, a more moderate, a more pro-American message. Whether it's tactical or not remains to be seen, but I affirm completely what she just said.
Lisa
What's
in Columbia.
Wait a second. Yeah. He just called Barack Obama anti-American. What is anti-American about getting the unemployment level down, seeing the Dow go up to 17,000, extending the Bush tax cuts, which conservatives like, but also giving payroll tax cuts to millions of Americans? What's anti-American about getting Osama bin Laden? What was anti-American about, you know, getting Gaddafi out of office? What is anti-American about any of this? This is why I'm getting a little bit irritated, because it's complete nonsense to get out there and call the president of the United States anti-American. I disagreed with everything, not everything, most of the things that Bush did. But I didn't believe he was anti-American. I believed he was wrong. There's a big difference
here. I believe Obama is wrong in that he is reducing America's
anti-American.
Hold on. Obama has been weakening our allies abroad. He's been strengthening our enemies. You look at, is Iran stronger or weaker since Obama came into office? Is Israel
Was Iran made stronger or weaker by the Iraq war?
It has a more moderate government. And look what's happening with, you know, because
Iran
of the
has
Iraq
a more moderate
war, we now
government?
Have ISIS. We know we have ISIS in Iraq, which doesn't make anyone better because of the Iraq war. And Iran actually has a more moderate government, not that moderate, but more moderate than it did before Obama came into office. So, I mean, you can play this a lot of different ways. And I will have a policy disagreement, an argument, debate with you as much as you want. But you keep bringing it back to these basic foundational facts, as you call them, that are not facts, that Obama has some sort of hatred for America, purposefully wants to weaken it. You've said that about Hillary as well, although you seem to be backtracking on this show. And so again and again and again, you try to put this in these grand terms that have a very conspiratorial notion, but yet here you are on the facts, on the individual cases, not being able to tie them to your grand notion.
If I may, let me go to our listeners again. London, Kentucky, Lucy. Lucy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. I feel like what Dinesh and his ilk are basically doing is distracting us from the real question in this country, and that's the growing inequality between the super rich and the very poor and the poor and the working class and even the middle class, which is disappearing and going who knows where. The housing stocks, the roads, everything is being destroyed by the likes of Dinesh and his ilk, as well as this growing.
Well, how are they destroying housing stock and infrastructure? Because they're not willing to spend to support.
Yes, by refusing to fund these elemental things that hold up, that allow working people to exist in this country.
Dinesh?
The reason for the abundance of the ordinary citizen's life in America is a society built on entrepreneurs. Now, these entrepreneurs are not stealing from anybody. If you look, for example, at Steve Jobs, he created a product that most of us didn't even know we wanted until he produced it, and then we couldn't live without it. What I see going on in America is a war between the wealth creators on the one side and an unproductive political class, resentment organizers like Obama. Obama couldn't come up with the iPhone. He can't even put up a website.
But you can't just have a golden Silicon Valley and unemployment beyond that, roads falling apart beyond that. You've got to have both, don't you? Kind of social investment and the engine of entrepreneurship and all the rest.
Steve Jobs would have been nowhere without the internet, which came about from the Defense Department, but from a government program. From government funding some basic science.
And that's
the only point that Obama makes. He's not against technological capitalism. He likes it. A lot of the guys in Silicon Valley have supported him. A lot haven't. But so it's not to point to Barack Obama and say he resents Steve Jobs because he himself didn't invent the iPod. Again, that's what I mean. This is absurd argument.
Don't we need both sides of that coin?
We do need both. Here's the point I'm making, that when Obama and Elizabeth Warren say you didn't build that, when they say in effect that Steve Jobs, for example, did not build the iPhone. Why? Because he took the public roads to get to the office, because an elementary school teacher taught him math in the fourth grade. This is actually Elizabeth Warren's speech saying there's no one in this country who got rich on their own. Now, here's the point. David, the progressives use this propaganda to justify government confiscation and takeover of wealth, and then you start running away from it when I quote it.
Nutty, Dinesh. We do need roads to get to work and to school, and we need schools that educate people
Barack
when
Obama,
we get there.
We all use the public roads. Why does Steve Jobs owe additional obligations to society? Because he uses the same roads that you and I do.
No, but everybody understands that if you profit very greatly from our system, you give back greatly. What's wrong with that?
It's a system of stability.
But we're not talking about giving back. Steve Jobs does give back a lot.
Well, I'm talking about giving back, but you call it confiscation, and I don't get that.
Wait a minute. There's a difference between the Bill Gates Foundation, in which Bill Gates gives back in all kinds of ways to society, and the government putting a gun to Bill Gates' head and confiscating his wealth, and 500
congressmen in Washington, D.C., deciding how to spend
Bill Gates' money.
Yeah. Wait a second. Are you saying there should be no taxation?
No, I'm not saying there should be no taxation, but I'm saying this is a specious argument that is used to justify more taxation.
So now we're just arguing about the level of taxation.
Of course,
and to
we
go
are.
On about Barack Obama being motivated by resentment and he hates these people. Listen, Warren Buffett and others who are very rich who have done very well supporting capitalism and technological investments, a lot of them look at Barack Obama's approach to this in terms of building infrastructure and building the community so that everybody benefits and that there's more innovation, and they agree with him. So you can't come along and say that for you to come along and pronounce him anti-American. I mean, more than half the country voted for the guy.
David, stand by. Dinesh, can we just go to that? There is a I understand some of your lines of critique, but then there's this bomb throwing quality that confuses me, because it is hard to see Obama as fundamentally anti-American. And why do you go to that? Why do you go to the Lucifer stuff? Well, Americans want a good country. They want an improving country. They're not against entrepreneurs. They're not against the social energy that can come out of capitalism. Why put it in such provocative terms that the people end up divided and spluttering rather than figuring out how to move productively forward?
All right. We are trying to understand what motivates Obama. The reason I talk about Obama's
still trying
formation,
is it that
hold on. Even right. As Obama came out of nowhere. It's not wrong
it's not
to be
nowhere. It's Hawaii.
No,
I was there
when
last
I say came
year.
Out of nowhere,
and
I mean
Harvard,
into the
and
political
Harvard Law
arena.
School and
Harvard
said it.
It's not nowhere.
No, what I mean is he was a relative unknown when he emerged on the national stage.
But now
stage.
We have 6 years.
He was
of
in
his
my
presidency.
Home state of Illinois as a state legislator. Guys. I don't understand why you put it in those kind of ooga booga scary terms out of
I
nowhere.
Wonder why. That's a
he
good
grew up
question.
In this country just like me.
It's not. Is it wrong to read his book and listen to his words to figure out what are the influences that shaped his character?
No, it's not. But it's wrong to say he came out of nowhere. Hawaii is not nowhere. Illinois is not nowhere. Chicago's not nowhere.
David asked me about resentment. Now, when I listen to Obama talk about this, and here's what he says. He'll talk about, he'll scorn and ridicule CEOs who fly around in corporate jets. Now, it doesn't escape my attention that Obama flies around in the very nicest jet of all, Air Force One. The difference, of course, is that the CEO CEOs pay for their own jets, whereas we pay for Obama's jet. So in Obama's point of view, it's okay for him to fly around in Air Force One, but it's wrong for CEOs to have little planes to get them from place to place.
Why did he extend the Bush tax cuts that the right loves so much? Why is the Dow doing so good? I mean, you focus on these most absurd points, all to make this grand point that really seems to make him the other, to delegitimize him. And I understand why a lot of Americans wonder why people on the right go so far to delegitimize this particular president.
David Korn, Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine. I know it wasn't your cup of tea, but you came on and we're grateful for it. David, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Tom.
Dinesh D'Souza, author of America, Imagine a World Without Her, and the companion film America. Dinesh in San Diego, thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Listeners, we gave it a shot. We hoped to get it over the bar. I don't know if we made it, but we'll keep trying. I appreciate you being here today, all your calls, and your innumerable comments online today. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.